investigative journalist Molly Barrows. For years, I've covered the stories that made headlines in Northwest Florida and all along the Gulf Coast. Murders. Missing persons. And mysteries of all kinds. These cases are far from over for many victims, because the full story has yet to surface. Join me for Gulf Coast Confidential, where I dive into the saltier side of the South and expose the lies, greed, and corruption that often weighs down the truth. It's time to turn the tide and get a shot at justice. Hi, I'm Molly Barrows, a longtime reporter in Florida's Panhandle, and welcome to my investigative series, Gulf Coast Confidential, where I dive into the saltier stories that surface in Northwest Florida and all along the Gulf of Mexico. My co-host, as always, is Pam Hill. Pam, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, and for those who aren't familiar, Pam's sister was killed by her son, Pam's nephew, on Christmas Eve of 2013. She's a pharmacist by trade, and of course, as a result of these traumatic experiences, she is also a grief and loneliness researcher. So she brings a unique perspective on a lot of the cases that we talk about here on Gulf Coast Confidential. And this is another bizarre one. It's called Blue on Blue Crime, No Bro Code. What are we talking about? Talking about a bizarre crime involving two police officers who came to the Gulf Coast for a conference, but only one of them left alive. So if you're not familiar with this case, here's a little recap. In 2019, Detective Michael Patrick Neely of Manford, Oklahoma, and his chief of police, also his friend, Chief Lucky Miller, were attending a law enforcement conference at the Hilton on Pensacola Beach. Well, after multiple complaints about noise from their hotel room, a security guard had to go in, and when he entered the room, he found Neely sitting on top of the police chief, Miller. Miller was pronounced dead just a short time later. So it's a bizarre case. A lot of people had a lot of questions at the time that it happened. We're going to get into some of those when we talk about the trial and the sentencing. But Pam, I remember when this case happened and how much people were talking about it. It's not unusual for people to get a little carried away, you know, to have a few beverages, especially when they're coming in from out of town. Mm-hmm. Pensacola Beach is beautiful. If you're not familiar with Pensacola Beach, the Gulf Coast is gorgeous. We call it the Emerald Coast for a reason. Beautiful emerald green waters of the Gulf Coast, white sands, sugar white sands. And it's a great place to attend a conference. And that's what these gentlemen were here to do. Two law enforcement officers going to a conference. It's not surprising they probably had beverages after one evening. But apparently they just... That led to a very bad situation all the way around. It seemed like, I don't know if that alcohol is to blame per se, but it's fair to say that they were both very drunk, according to the tests that showed their blood alcohol level. And I don't, not to say that that excuses anything, but it certainly, I mean, what a bizarre and violent crime, a terrible way to go.
It's amazing. I remember when it was on TV, I couldn't wrap my head around it because they were both policemen. They were here on a fun event and something educational. They're at the beautiful Hilton. We do live in paradise here. And so, of course, they want to come here from Oklahoma and have a good time. I think it was in November of 2019. So a lot of times during COVID, when COVID was around and these cases were developing, we kind of lost track of things because we had other things popping up like COVID numbers and people couldn't get into the courthouse and a lot of things were shut down during that time. So I just couldn't wrap my head around it. And I was like, wait a minute, the police, one of the police is dead and the other policeman killed him and Escambia County Sheriff's Department's investigating. It was really hard because to wrap your head around it. And these guys were buddies. They were friends. Lucky was the boss, his police captain.
Not anymore.
No, he's not anymore. But I mean, he'd been the police captain for 12 years. And this guy was his right-hand guy.
I know, it's so bizarre. And when you find out what happened, like how he killed his right-hand guy, how he killed his boss, the police chief, it's just terrible. So during Neely's trial, because of course he was tried for murdering his friend, one of the experts testified that Miller suffered about 5 blunt force traumatic injuries to his head before he died. The pathologist said that Miller's body showed signs of strangulation and smothering because he had discoloration of his face, bleeding from his eyes, and his neck muscles were injured. Of course, Neely was 50 when he was sentenced to life in prison for that crime in 2021. But it was just bizarre during that trial to hear all of the details from the medical examiner, because this was a very violent crime. At one point, they said that it was basically the equivalent to, he had injuries that were the equivalent of being in a car crash.
Right.
Just the sustained trauma. What else did you learn when you were researching?
Well, when I was reading it, they basically said that he had been internally decapitated, which would mean that his skull was unattached from his spine and neck, but there wasn't a cut through like we think of decapitation in its other sense, I guess, and that basically muscles and skin were just holding his head there. And I mean, it's just awful because both of these guys were fit. Can you imagine how much force and how much of a flurry, and his right-hand guy kills him with his right hand? And when they find them up in the room, because basically with all the fracas and noise, plenty of people complained to the front desk, and they couldn't get them to answer the phone and all kind of things like that, because I guess they didn't hear it. So when they send the maintenance man in there, he knocks and knocks on the door many, many times, and he hears like these primal grunts. You know, it just scares him to death. When he opens the door, there's Neely sitting on top of Lucky Miller.
Good Lord. So he still was in the act, if you will.
Right. And they had to take him off of him. And I think he kind of got scratched up a little bit by them taking him off of his friend slash boss. Because they said that people heard outside the room, they heard Lucky say, they didn't know it was Lucky at the time, they heard someone say, "Stop it, Mike." Okay. "Then stop it, Mike. If you don't stop it, when we get home, I'm going to fire you." That's what people said they heard.
Oh, wow. And we don't know what sparked the argument.
I don't even know if it was an argument. I think it was a drunken-fueled night. Who knows? And I don't know if it was their room together. You know, when people travel, they usually get one room together so they can save money, or they're friends and probably enjoy each other's company. But would you ever think that they would get in that one little room at Pensacola Beach? What in the world could they have been talking about or thinking about or doing that caused that kind of interaction?
I know, and especially, let's just even assume that, you know, because the tests did show that they were both extremely drunk, and of course, Neely even more so, but you can't help but think that there must have been something more bottled up inside him to unleash like that. Mm-hmm. Whether he intended to ever unleash it on his best friend, clearly there's some rage issues there. There's some tendency towards violence. Maybe he's been holding some things in for a long time is where my mind goes. Mm-hmm.
Or maybe he snapped when he told him, "If you don't stop it, when we get home, I'm going to fire you." Maybe he didn't like that ultimatum. But I think that was, and they said that when they went in there for Michael Neely, that his eyes were just wild eyes with nothing behind them. You know, just big
black
eyes.
Out.
Yeah, just black eyes. And just like they were talking to him, no response. He didn't respond to them. Mm. And when they would question him, he was in, because I remember looking at this too when it happened, he was in sort of like a hospital gown, and his thigh was sticking out, is like bare-legged, barefooted, handcuffed to the table there, and he just kept his head down. But he said, "Who's dead?" And he didn't realize that. He said, I guess I better stop talking if he's dead.
Wow. That's incredible. I mean, that was, I guess, a smart response from a law enforcement officer who's familiar with trying to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, if I found out that I had just killed my friend, I think I would, it's an odd reaction.
Right. It is. And I think, I don't know what state he was in, they said they were both four times the legal limit for driving for alcohol. So that's quite a bit. And, you know, this is second degree murder that he's being charged with. So maybe he's got some sense to be quiet. He is a policeman. But I just can't imagine. I looked at these guys. I looked at their pictures. They're both fit, like not exactly football players now, but like they might have been football players back in the day. They're fit policemen. Their necks, you know how guys that are fit and lift weights, it's not like a small neck or something like that. So I just, I just can't even imagine.
I know. And apparently neither could Neely's wife, you know, when it came time mm-hmm. for sentencing after he was convicted of second-degree murder. Basically, she pleaded for the court to show mercy and asked mm-hmm. the judge not to sentence him to life in prison. She said, quote, "Mike would never intentionally hurt someone. I've lived with him for 21 years. I know this. Please have leniency and mercy upon us." But, you know, as you can imagine, Lucky Miller's family wanted the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. They were like, please give him the harshest possible punishment for second-degree murder. And you know, a member of Lucky Miller's family said a man, quote, "a man who was drunk brutally killed my son with his bare hands because of alcohol." Of course, this was Lucky Miller's dad. And as you mentioned, they were both extremely intoxicated. But Miller's widow, Amber Miller, also told the court about, you know, all the things that as a couple they were going to miss, including, you know, having their father at the weddings of their children or going on trips or just having him to be a source of advice throughout their lives. And what really broke my heart was his mom, Lucky Miller's mom, Joanne, crying just as soon as, you know, she said her name aloud for the court record. And I think you can relate to this, mm-hmm. but, you know, she told the court that their family had, quote unquote, collateral damage from her son's murder, that her own mother, 94 years old, who was Lucky Miller's grandmother, had trouble even comprehending the news that he had been murdered and, quote, never had a happy day after that, unquote. And she died only 34 days after learning of her grandson's death. Mm. And she said, quote, "and 3 days later, once again, we sat in front of an open grave," Joanne Miller said, end quote. And it's just tragic because I know you can relate to that. You know, if you're not familiar with Pam's case and the story of her sister being killed by her son, Brandon Ate a Lot, then you'll want to check out Mommy Killer 1 and 2, as well as Confessions in the Field House and Murder and Madness. Those are a few episodes that we've done that are related to her case. But, you know, Pam's sister was murdered by her son in 2013, and their mother was only 74 at the time, but she died less than a year later, mm-hmm. essentially of a broken heart mm-hmm. to a certain extent. She had some health issues, but nothing that had been creeping up on her mm-hmm. to the point of death. But after Sharon's death, it was like, I think sometimes people just lose the will mm-hmm. to live.
Yeah. It was exactly 1 year after we buried Sharon, and it was my mom's. Sharon was our baby, and then it was my mom's baby's child that killed her. So I know it was hard for me even, but I can only imagine a mother. That's your child. And my mother died of a broken heart, just like Lucky's grandmother did.
Yes.
And I mean, it's called Takotsubo is what it's called. There is a condition, a broken heart syndrome, broken heart condition. And Takotsubo in Japanese means octopus. So you feel like an octopus is just around your heart and it's just squeezing. Breathing becomes hard, living, just picking out what you want to eat or get in your car. I watched my mom, and she tried to do her very best for us. But I mean, in my family, we love each other very, very much. And, you know, I'm sure the Millers do too, like most families do. But grief like that, that's out of the blue sky, it's disenfranchised grief, and it's senseless. There's no, and that the hands of someone else that you loved and cared about, it is, you cannot describe that to people. It is like a living hell. Because people basically are like, hey, get over it, move on. And a lot of people will tell you that, to get over it. I can promise you this with grief, any grief. You will not get over it. You will get through it. And the Lord has promised us beauty for ashes. But grief is one of the most misunderstood things until you have a VIP ticket to experience it yourself.
Yes, I know that's certainly true, and you can certainly hear it in the testimony that a lot of Lucky Miller's family members mm-hmm. gave at Neely's sentencing. And, you know, as a courts and crime reporter for years, I've covered a lot of those trials and sentencings, and I've seen lots of family members get up there and talk about the impact that losing a loved one to violent crime has cost them, what mm-hmm. it's done to them, what it's done to their families, as well as just interviewed families in the wake of tragedies that happen. And you're right, there's a shell shockness, and it is horrible enough to lose a loved one. Mm-hmm. I've lost both of my parents to illness. Fortunately, it was not to violent crime. Loss is loss, and it does hurt. But I will say that talking to people who are survivors of violent crime, which are those that have lost loved ones to violent crime as well, It is different. It's this gaping hole of why it didn't have to happen. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain, I think, questioning that comes with even illnesses. If it's cancer or a disease that mm-hmm. takes a loved one, why was there no cure? Why my loved one? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. so you do question. But I think to have someone ripped away from you so unexpectedly, so violently, and my heart even goes out to Neely's wife mm-hmm. as well. Of mm-hmm. course she's going to petition the court for leniency. Of course she knows a different man than the man that mm-hmm. killed Lucky Miller that night.
Right. It doesn't make sense to her either. This all nonsense stuff at all. And grief is basically love with nowhere to go. We love these people that were here. They were our loved ones. And it's the receipt that we hold that we loved someone. So the best thing I feel like people can do in grief is to have their feelings and to talk to a trusted other or to sit with them yourself, because over time, things do ease up a little bit. But these victim impact statements, I never knew what a victim impact statement was per se. Personally, I'd heard people on TV shows get up and they're screaming at the person that did, that killed their family member or something. But that's really not what a victim impact statement's about. It is exactly like it says. A victim tells what happened and what the impact is on their life. And I can tell you, until I was able to read my victim impact statement in open court to Judge Simon, that was one of the single best pieces of healing for me personally, because I got to tell what a wonderful person Sharon was, how our lives will never be the same, and how we're going, the better parts of us will always be her, instead of you can't get the loved one back.
I know, and my heart goes out to his sister, too, Lucky Miller's sister, Katie Landrum. And I think you'll relate to some of what she told the court at Neely's sentencing, too. She said that she and her brother were only one grade apart, and mm-hmm. they shared a lot of the same friends, activities, and memories. I know you were older than Sharon, mm-hmm. but you can certainly remember what it was like when you were all in school together and, you know, growing up together. But she said, quote, "Since his death, I feel an odd sense of loneliness about me. This family comes from a place of knowing that a part of me is dead." And while Landrum said she has faith that the panic attacks and depression that she started to suffer after her brother's death will one day go away, she did speak about her terror that sense of loneliness will never mm-hmm. fade. Quote, "One of the things I struggle with the most is trying to understand how the person who was his partner and friend and knows all of us, ultimately the person who should have been there to protect Lucky, was the one who took his life, even when Lucky was pleading with him to stop," Landrum said. "I cannot fathom how a person, especially one who was sworn to serve and protect others, could take someone else's life with his bare hands," end quote.
Mm. I get it. I 100% get it. It makes no sense whatsoever. And I think the more that we do these cases, there are so many senseless acts, and we keep going back to that conflict resolution. If we add alcohol, or if we add a narcissistic personality, or we add people that just want their way all the time, I mean, nothing good's going to come out
or
of all that.
Or pent-up emotion that they've not dealt with.
Exactly. I am a feelings girl, and I know you are too. I think feelings are like waves. They come and go. It washes over you. It washes out. But a lot of us have very simplistic way of thinking about feelings, sometimes thought happy, sad, glad, mad. I didn't realize something like playful is a feeling until I had counseling. And when you can name the feeling, like I'm afraid, or I'm intimidated, or I feel insecure, those feelings, when you can name them, that takes away a lot of the power from them. Or I'm scared. We don't like to say those things, but I have...
Being vulnerable.
Exactly. And vulnerability equals intimacy. And that's the only way you're going to be intimate with someone, is to be vulnerable.
Absolutely.
So it just makes sense. But lessons that have cost me the most are the ones that I remember forever.
And are those some of your takeaways from this case, is, you know, basically being self-aware? And, you know, I don't know that there is any way that this could have been prevented if somebody doesn't even realize that they're capable of such a thing and allow themselves to get so wasted that they're capable, you know, mm-hmm. or that they would even mm-hmm. attempt it.
Right. And I think we just never say never. You think, that would never happen in my family. And going through a lot of counseling and stuff, I have learned there's something called the YET Society, Y-E-T. you're eligible too. And if you think things can't happen in your family, they can. I never thought this would happen in mine. Lucky and them never thought that would happen in theirs. So I think have your feelings. You and I have talked about this many, many times. It helps me to be able to talk to you and other people that I love and trust about how I feel. And then the feeling doesn't have as much control, or it's maybe just fleeting. So I think have your feelings, talk to people. Some things, I don't want to just say some things are just going to be, you know, but heaven's sakes, what could we have done to stop this situation?
I tell you, my takeaway is get another room.
Yes,
like I'm
right.
just gonna, you
exactly.
know, if I go out of town with a coworker or a friend, mm-hmm. I'm just gonna say, you
get
know,
your own.
Right? I think I'll be in my own room. Thanks so much. But no, I mean, I don't mean to make light of it, but it's things like that that I'm sure all of their families think. Mm-hmm. 2020, if only there hadn't been one more drink, mm-hmm. if only there hadn't been this opportunity. But like you said, nobody can necessarily predict it coming. But what can we learn from it? And those would be my takeaways.
Yeah.
You know,
and I just feel it. It's so unfortunate that they were here to study death investigation at a conference, and it ends up being a death investigation.
I know. They were a real live example.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Pam, thank you so much for joining me.
You're very welcome.
And thank you for joining us for Blue on Blue Crime, No Bro Code. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Gulf Coast Confidential. I'm your host, writer, and producer, Molly Barrows, with co-host and researcher, Pam Hill. And a big thanks, as always, to director, editor, and production engineer, James Roy. You can listen to more of Gulf Coast Confidential and our conversations wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And you can also watch on the Gulf Coast Confidential YouTube channel. Don't forget to like and subscribe, and we'll see you next time.